Hey everybody, welcome back to another Bald Movie Podcast. This time we are looking at the Oliver Stone 1989 film, Born on the 4th of July. It's based on the book of the same title written by Ron Kovic, which is about his life story, growing up in small town America, going over to Vietnam, as an ardent supporter of the war, coming back and becoming part of the anti-war protest movement. Oliver Stone and Ron Kovic worked together on a screenplay. Oliver Stone, of course, also a Vietnam veteran of some distinction. It stars Tom Cruise. I think everybody knows who Tom Cruise is as Ron Kovic. Kira Sedgwick, who you might remember as the terrible mom from Secondhand Lions and the shitty John Travolta movie Phenomenon. She's also starred for many years on TNT's The Closer. Raymond J. Barry, who I did not recognize as Arlo Givens, the father of one Raylan Givens from Justified, which I quite enjoyed. Frank Whaley, which you might most know him as the Brett with the big brain from Pulp Fiction. Willem Dafoe. Do we need to talk about Willem Dafoe's filmography? No. I mean, I'm going to anyway. Platoon, Last Temptation of Christ, Mississippi Burning, Spider-Man, Shadow of the Vampire, Boondock Saints, Antichrist, just a small selection. Born on the 4th of July received 8 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture and Best Actor for Tom Cruise, which was his first nomination, and it won for Best Director, Oliver Stone's second, his first was for Platoon, and Best Film Editing. Boy, I've never seen this film before. I don't know if you had. And I kind of knew roughly what it was about. And I still found it a difficult film to watch, not because of any problem with the filmmaking. It's just frustrating because it does feel like watching this in 2020 that in many ways American politics just has never moved on from the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
What did you think of the film, Jim?
I hadn't seen it either. Really, the only thing I knew about it going in was that it was an Oliver Stone directed, Tom Cruise starred movie about the Vietnam War, which, you know, if you listen to our The Five Bloods review, I'm very unfamiliar with the history of the Vietnam War and, you know, the politics surrounding it. And so I guess I didn't know much of what to expect from this film, but I ended up really liking it. I think it has a way of sort of just letting the experiences on screen speak for themselves. And, you know, the movie clearly has a lot to say, as I think Ron Kovic would have a lot to say and probably does in his biography, his autobiography. But this movie doesn't, like, spell it all out for you. And in some ways, you know, it's maybe rides that line a little too much to one side of not spelling it out. Because yeah. I did find myself, like, going, oh, okay, I see that his character is changing, but I'm not exactly sure of the inflection points. Like, what specifically was it that made him change his mind? But then again, I think that's very close to how real life works on the human brain, right? Like, your experiences, and I think this movie is ultimately about, like, how someone's mind is changed on a topic. Especially when they feel very strongly about it and haven't questioned why they feel strongly about it. And I think over the course of the film, it does a really good, subtle job of showing you just how Ron Kovic changed his mind based on his experiences.
Yeah. And it wasn't like a black and white, oh my God, you know, it was a slow, steady slide from one extreme position to another one. And it's funny that you mentioned that, because I got the same thing. Like, man, they are doing, like, I kept on waiting for, like, this big soliloquy.
Yeah.
But, like, when he does have, like, you know, a soliloquy, it's usually some rage, alcohol, profane, not really well thought out kind of thing. It's more of just like the emotional experiential thing. And it just, this takes place over the course of years and years of time. And it's also really funny because like 2 weeks ago, I think I recorded that Three Right Turns 19 over on Swizzbold. And it was all about the process of how people change their mind, like you said, on deeply held things that they haven't really considered before and how it can often take years. And I think this movie, you know, he enlists in 68 and he becomes an anti-war activist by 72. So, like, and he got, you know, how much more of a shove in a different direction do you need than to come home from this war See how the country treats its veterans on either side of the political aisle. See how they treat them in their hospitals. Mm-hmm. Be paralyzed. Be impotent. You know, be reviled by your own family. Like, it's like all that. You think it would be so easy to just, but you can't. You can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just shows how like people's feelings on these matters run really deep. But I, you know, Oliver Stone, I'm all over the place with him. Like, I always, especially on stuff I'm not really familiar, I'm always skeptical of, like, you know, what is he amping up? What is he leaving out? I feel like this film, because it's based on, first of all, he's got firsthand knowledge. You know, he saw combat. If you didn't know, he, like Ron Kovic, voluntarily enlisted early on in the war in 1968, I think April of 68, joined up with the army, requested combat service, spent over, I think 2 years in Vietnam, got two Purple Hearts, got a bronze a star with a V for valor in combat. I mean, he knows what the fuck he's talking about, and he's made two of the best movies about Vietnam. And I felt like, because he respects that and Ron's story, like, this stuff, even the stuff where they're, you know, you got the obligatory, I feel like, scene of the GIs shooting up a village that may or may not have been harboring, you know, communist sympathizers. If they weren't before, they are now.
Yeah.
And killing the kids and killing the babies and, you know, the fratricide and all that kind of stuff. But Oliver Stone also does a very good job of putting you kind of in that experience, that is, and you know, see like how confusing that would be to see the pressure of, like, do you see the rifle? Do you see the right? Your commanding officer is like telling you what you see, and are you going to be the person that says no? And then what happens if one of your friends dies? And then the same thing when he comes home and he's in the VA hospital, like, you are disgustingly there in that, in the squalor, and kind of like, you can see the budget cuts and you can see the lackadaisical attitudes, and he's really good at that. And not for nothing, he's got Johnny Williams propping him up on the score. So every single fucking emotional beat that you need to connect these dots of this man's internal conflict is it fires on all cylinders cinematically. And I think this is some of his best work.
It's sort of a crazy choice to put Cruise at the front of this film, like,
especially at this point in his career.
Yeah, so at this point in his career, he's known for Top Gun, he's known for Risky Business, he's known
Cocktail.
Yeah, he's like,
Have Rain Man.
His review pointed it, said it as he's the Golden Boy, right? And that's what everybody thinks of Tom Cruise as, kind of even still today, even though he's done so much other work. It's a really risky business putting Tom Cruise at the front of this film, in the lead actor role. But I think, honestly, like, if you want Tom Cruise's best, most interesting performances, you got to go to movies like this. You got to go to movies like Vanilla Sky. You got to go to movies like Magnolia. Mm-hmm. Stuff where he's doing more. He's doing something other than just
Tropic
smiling
Thunder
and being charismatic, you know, or running and jumping. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. And I think that especially at this stage in his career, when he was this pretty boy, when he was this golden boy, to, you know, because he does like that, the Pete from Mad Men, or they inflict a receding hairline on him.
Yeah, yeah.
And he is unattractive throughout a lot of the film, and not just physically. You know, it's like, whatever, he's still Tom Cruise, but like, he's also hard to, even after you've seen everything he's been through, there's some points where he's just such a fucking unrepentant asshole because of the experiences he's gone through and the things he's seen and the things he's experiencing at home. You know, it's sometimes hard, traumatized, you know, it's what is that, the phrase, hurt people. And when they do it, it's kind of ugly. And there's this really powerful moment, the Willem Dafoe, where he kind of like looks at him. It's kind of like looking at himself in the mirror and being like, Jesus Christ, is this what I'm going to let this experience do to me?
Yeah.
Is this all, or is there anything more I can do? And, you know, and there's, man, this is where the thing I kind of raise my eyebrows about the Hollywood shit, when they show like Kovacs as a kid playing soldier, when you see Like his never quit attitude, climbing the rope, and in different situations where he's down on he's down pinned on the mat. Like they make direct connections to those. Like this is what's going to enable him to get up and start the second chapter of his career. And you know, Tom Cruise like fucking brings it. You know, he's not sparing his golden boy image at all, and allowing himself to be this unlikable and unattractive at points. I thought was you know amazing. And you know, I want to at some point talk about alternate casting because there's a doozy.
we can do that maybe here in a minute. But I just wanted to point out also the subtlety in his acting here, because Tom Cruise has one of the best like stunned faces, I think, in all of Hollywood, where there's something like his eyes open just a little more, his jaw goes a little bit slack, and you can see that there's something going on behind his eyes. Like he's having realizations, he's struggling with things. And you know, Tom Cruise doesn't get a lot of credit for that kind of acting. But I really appreciate in those moments where he's able to say more than the script does with just his acting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I know what scene you're talking, like the first anti-war protest he goes to and sees.
Or that 4th of July parade when he comes back to town and he's expected to give the speech, and he's just there's something incongruous, right, with his experience or his beliefs and what's happening in front of him.
Yeah.
He does a really good job
expressing
that.
You know, hearing the guy set him up with like, and we're absolutely going to win. Should we talk a little bit? Should we tell people? Because like I imagine there's a lot of people who haven't seen this film. It came out in 89. If you're in our generation, that's like I remember that. Like that was when I was like a freshman in high school. It's funny because, you know, Born on the 4th of July and Platoon were not exactly universally popular movies. They were very popular critically and in Hollywood because, you know, you'd expect liberals to enjoy it. But I remember growing up in small town Indiana, and I remember in one history class, one of my freshman history teachers started railing against Oliver Stone, talking like he didn't fucking know what he did, wasn't, and he was making our servicemen look like they were baby killers and buying in and all that bullshit. And one of the kids stood up and said, well, I don't know. Oliver Stone went to Vietnam. He thinks it's pretty accurate. And then the teacher started like arguing with this kid, and then the kid said, you know, also my dad went to Vietnam and he says it was right on too. Did you go to Vietnam, sir? And like there's this big blowout in my freshman high school history class in Mooresville, fucking Indiana.
Wow.
And I was thinking, you know, since then I've learned a lot about the world. I've changed a lot of my own conclusions. And especially about the Vietnam War, you know, seeing like Ken Burns documentary and just different, you know, just picking up things along the way. It's really hard for me to process the fact that there's still people that think that was like it was a winnable cause and it was a just cause to be in. But I know that like, you know, I said, as in many ways, I feel like we're still fighting a lot of political battles, a lot of the stuff that we fought in Vietnam. Should I kind of give a synopsis of this film?
Yeah, for sure.
Tom Cruise plays Ron Kovic, who is an all-American small-town boy growing up in, I guess, a small suburb or town out on Long Island. He is extremely patriotic. He's extremely driven to be the best and to succeed. And at the end of his high school career, the Marine recruiters show up and say, if you want to be the best, son, you want to put on this uniform. And he volunteers for combat, serves two tours of duty in Vietnam in a confusing mess of a village raid. He gets wounded to the point where he is paralyzed from the chest down. He has a harrowing experience in a VA hospital. He has a harrowing experience returning to civilian life. And slowly but surely, he turns from the man who thinks that the United States government can do no wrong and no amount of sacrifice is too much for his country to ask, to a man who questions why we are there, why we are abandoning and turning our backs on his brothers in arms, and becomes an important figure in the anti-war movement in the 70s. There you go. That's the movie. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that I watched this and I had like a personal relationship with the film. The fact that like, you know, gee whiz, when you look at this protest stuff, when you look at what people are saying about the Vietnam War in the middle of the Vietnam War versus like the last war I can remember, the second Desert Storm, the second Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, it's so fucking the same. Like the chants, the slogans, the things used on both sides of the argument, But reading Ebert's review, like I think you said you did too, reminded me the historical context of this film is this was released as communism was essentially taking a nosedive around the world. The Soviet Union was collapsing and fragmenting. The Berlin Wall had fallen. Many, many Eastern Bloc governments issuing official apologies for, like, you know, behaviors both home and abroad. And Ebert made a point that, like, America will never do that. America will never apologize for our foreign blunders. But what we will do is we'll have our artists kind of like make these films. I thought that was, you know, like, again, set in the time of like the fact that the Soviet Union was collapsing under its own weight, and its own like imperial, dreams and desires. It makes it makes you really wonder, especially after seeing the Ken Burns documentary, what if we had just not done that? What if we had not, you know, imposed our will in some of these Asian countries and our South American countries? What if communism just collapsed without us firing a shot? You know, what if we were there with food and medical ships when they had famines and, you know, there's like just like, hey, self-evidently, our way of doing things is better. Mm-hmm. You know, what would the world be a better place, or would we all be living in like Eastern Bloc Soviet style concrete condominiums and shit, and speaking Cyrillic? I don't know.
Yeah,
but that's the thing I was thinking when I was watching this.
If we do one more of these Vietnam era movies, I'm gonna have to go watch that Ken Burns documentary, because I don't have the context for it. I was very young at the time. I was about 7 years old when this movie came out.
I thought you said during the Vietnam War. I'm like, what?
No.
Yeah. But yeah, I thought about that, and the fact that like America was riding high on the world stage, like, you know, we had whipped the fascists in World War One. We'd done it again in World War Two. Mm-hmm. You know, the Korean War was maybe fought to a tie, but we saved half the peninsula from the communists. And look at North Korea today. That's a shitty situation. I feel like that the national sentiment was that we were the good guys. We could do no wrong. There's no, you know, like Kennedy, Democratic superstar, with his, you know, we are going to oppose communism everywhere. There's no sacrifice too much. There's no price we will not pay. And then you see the kids, like the way they played war and the way that, like, when they're talking about each other in the diners, like, man, the way these Marines are talking, the Vietnam War might be over in a year. We can't wait. We got to enlist now. There is this kind of cycle of kind of, I guess, war hysteria, where it's like war, the sacrifices were noble and the heroics are real. And that really appeals to young men when you're 18 to 26.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially in that era, in the late 50s, mid 60s, that kind of thing. Like, you can, I think, be forgiven for thinking that the Americans won't get into a war that's unjust. Because they have, you know, come, you know, I don't want to inflate the ego of America too much. We don't deserve it at this point, but like, there was a sense back then that America was sort of the hero of the world, and they would come to save you if you needed that, right? Like, Europe needed us in World War II, and we were there for them.
Right.
So the idea that like Vietnam might turn into something that would be despised both locally in America and also on the world stage is sort of anathema, you know, to the people of that era. They just can't conceive of it.
And I think that, like, then you have the first Desert Storm, and I remember a lot of skepticism about, like, oh man, what if this is another, you know, Vietnam? What if this for? And it went so shockingly well. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just this one-sided, minimal bloodshed, at least from the Allies' standpoint, that I wonder if it gave us some kind of false bravado going into the second Iraq adventure that we're still embroiled in, between that and Afghanistan. And the thing I found shocking is, you know, like 2 years ago, was it 2 years ago? It's just these last couple of years have been a blur. But when, you know, the United States assassinated the Iranian general, the Soleimani, and mm-hmm. there was kind of felt like, you know, there was the world was on a brink of like, oh, shit. Or, you know, is this going to get us involved more in Syria? Is the Russians going to get in? Oh, my God, what are we doing? I felt like the old debate started right back up. You know, it was like the Toby Keith put a boot in your ass. versus, hey, wait a minute, what the fuck are we doing? And the people saying, hey, wait a minute, what the fuck are we doing? Well, you're not fucking America and love it or leave it. All that shit just started up, and it also spun down just as quickly because nothing ever came of it.
Yeah.
But like, that's the thing where I'm talking about. Like, it's like no one learns anything. And I hate the phrase both sides, but like I thought one thing that like let the left or the progressive left or whatever liberals would learn from the Vietnam War is it's not a great strategy when soldiers come home to like spit on them and call them baby killers, et cetera, except for like last week there was this lady who works. I mean, admittedly, she's working for the Army's esports, you know, outreach program, which is essentially have you seen this?
I know.
You know, I used to go. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I know they have a video game designed explicitly for recruiting, yes.
Which is weird. And I remember, because like, I used to go to a bunch of air shows, and they'd always pull this trailer, America's Army, and it would have this VR.
It's not amazing.
No, but it's like the VR experience is kind of cool. But it's essentially like, you know, wars of kind of a video game and cool, and look what you can do. And you've played Call of Duty. Do it for real, son.
Yeah.
So like... Yet this lady, she takes over the PR thing for this Army's esports thing, a recruiting thing, and people immediately start calling her baby killer and a war criminal and kind of hound her off the internet. I don't know. I feel like, you know, there is a construct like the Matrix where you can emotionally bootstrap yourself and make those arguments. Like, well, okay, if you're going to carry the Army's water and you're going to help them recruit and you see our mission around the world, you know, then maybe everyone's in there is complicit. But there's also the real world where, you know, most people get into, I think, the military in this country because the same reason my dad did. My dad volunteered for Vietnam. Because he was a poor fucking white farmer from Waverly, Indiana, and that's the only way he saw out. That's the only way he ever thought he would get a college education. And he did. And I feel like the vast majority of people sign up because they see it as a way out of their town. Predominantly, everyone that signs up, you know, lots of minorities, lots of poor kids, lots of people from places that are economically ravaged, and the recruiters tell them that, hey, go here, serve 4 years for your country, Uncle Sam will take care of you, and they sign up. They're not doing it because they want to go kill, and they're and they believe in a particular mission, or even if they do, like a lot of that stuff is, yeah, that's the official propaganda. So like, how do you blame them? And I don't know, because I feel like I feel like that's the one lesson that maybe my side would have learned from Vietnam, and I don't think we have. I think that in another conflict, we'd be right back to the baby killing and war criminal and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Seems like it. You know, we're getting a small taste of that with our police system here currently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's tough. It's tough when, you know, you have blurry lines, I guess, between the government and the people who are inside of the organizations in the government. And I think like, if you look at it from a macro level, you can just sort of blame everyone involved, including soldiers, who may just be, you know, farm town kids who didn't have any hopes for the future. And so they joined up and they got stuck in something they don't even agree with, but mm-hmm. you know, it's tough. And I think this movie does a pretty good job of pointing out those distinctions that should be made, but also how they're not often made. Mm-hmm. Like when COVID comes back, you know, we saw in that moment, he tried to do everything right. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He, the confusion, it was crazy. The thing that he did wrong, the mistake he made is he shot his buddy. But he wasn't the one who opened fire on those kids with the people without the rifles. Like, you know, I don't know, but he comes back and suddenly he's treated like this monster.
Right.
When that was never his intention. And I don't know. It's tough because like I said, this movie does a subtle job of developing this character of Kovic and explaining the reasons for his change of heart. And I think, I don't know. I like the way that they manifest in the movie because there are some scenes where it's heartbreaking. Some scenes where it's hilarious. Like that scene with his mom where it's both heartbreaking and hilarious. Like he's in his house. He's drunk. You know, he's regretting the decisions he's made. He's angry about how he's being treated. And he comes home and he just starts shouting penis at his mother, you know, just trying.
She doesn't allow that language in her house.
Intentionally trying to offend her. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was cracking up that whole scene because it's funny, but like also it's tragic. And I think there's just so much of that mix in there, right? This movie is one of subtlety, not black and white lines.
Yeah. I think that's another a point that I've tried to take in. And, because even the quote-unquote good wars, there was a lot of atrocities committed by the quote-unquote good guys.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that we have to realize about war is, like, you have to decide whether the war needs to be fought. And because and you have to think about that really carefully, because once you make that decision, bad shit's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, you try to hold your soldiers responsible and whatnot, but there is going to be friendly fire. There is going to be fog of war. There is going to be guys that have seen their buddies' brains get blown out in their laps and want to go out and get revenge. That all comes as part of it, and it always has. Like, it's not a bloodless business. It's a really grim, fucking awful, dehumanizing business. And then we want to be shocked when inhuman things happen. So, like, it's not necessarily like, you know, like the fact that the Allies firebombed Dresden is problematic, but like you also still had to fight World War II. The fact that these GIs shot up a village and killed kids is problematic, but it's extra problematic because, you know, when you go back and step back and say, should they even have been there? The answer is pretty much a resounding no. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of like chemotherapy, right? Like, if you're going through chemotherapy because you actually have cancer, then that's a bad situation, but you're making the best of it. If you're a healthy person, the doctor says, you know what? I think I need to put you on chemo. And they put you on chemo and you lose your hair and you die after 6 months and you didn't even have cancer. Well, that's a fucking nightmare.
Yeah.
So, and I feel like that's what I feel is the kind of like actual deal about Vietnam is it was chemotherapy for cancer that didn't necessarily exist, or if it did, had no chance of spreading to us or any of our major allies. Or if it's time for, you know, like the time to do chemotherapy, I guess, is like when the Soviets would roll into West Germany. You know, that's when you should start the chemo, not when, you know, a paramilitary organization takes over a South American country or an actual, you know, revolutionary freedom fighting force tries to take over Vietnam. Like, if we don't agree with communism, but we do agree with a country's ability to self-determine, don't you have to let those countries have their own social experiments, right? You know? America overthrowing a fucking king was very controversial. That's a new form of government that was completely untested, and a lot of Europe didn't like it. I'm super glad we got to try it, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, man. I'm definitely not a historian. I'm definitely not an expert on, you know, reasons that we go to war. But yeah, it does seem like the consensus now is that Vietnam was a mistake.
I thought it was interesting how they also showed like the expectations and how much that like his mom and dad had expectations for him. Like when his mom tells him when he's like 8 years old, I had a dream that you were in front of a bunch of people and addressing them and saying important things, like, holy shit. And then I knew also just from the things that she was saying, like, oh man, this mom's going to be trouble later in the movie. And she was like, the idea that your son's come home with, you know, nothing below the waist working, and you're going to obsess about how much he's drinking and him saying the word penis. Mm-hmm. and kick him out. That's a rough scene to watch as a guy who's a difficult relationship with his mother.
Sure.
And hasn't exactly had the emotional support from her that he's needed over the years. I thought the movie kicked up another notch when they went down to Mexico and Willem Dafoe, you know, man, co-star of Platoon shows up.
Fucking Willem Dafoe. I've got Willem Dafoe sucking the worm out of a bottle of mezcal and wriggling his tongue at me is now in my nightmares. I don't like it.
If you can't, what is it? You can't move your hips. You better be able to move your lips or something.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oof.
And yeah. How that's so I that's the other thing is like they don't fully explain everything that's happening in the movie, right? Mm-hmm. like the reasons he moves down to Mexico, I'm guessing, is because he was getting this disability check from the government. Probably wasn't enough to just live by himself. And he's getting kicked out of his home because he's being a drunken asshole. So I guess a lot of these disabled GIs are moving down to Mexico because their money probably went 10 to 20 times faster or further.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is this community, and you first you get down there, it's like, oh my God, this is like they literally say it's paradise. But eventually it kind of collapses onto itself because, you know, these men have been rejected by their society and they've been crippled by this war, and there's not enough drugs, alcohol, and prostitutes to drown all those feelings. But I thought the scene of when they get thrown out of the taxi and they're like angrily circling each other in their wheelchairs on the side of that Mexican road was just amazing in its ferocity. And William Dafoe just like swinging for the fences on all every one of those scenes. This is just an amazing performance.
Yeah. And you said something about it. Because I was trying to, like I said earlier, pinpoint sort of things that changed his mind. And you brought up that that scene is one of those things. And of course, it's the scene that leads to him heading back to the U.S. And I think like what you said about it, where he looked at Willem Dafoe and they had this confrontation and he realized that's what he was spiraling toward.
Right.
If he didn't sort of reclaim his life and not let this define him for the rest of it. That makes a lot of sense. You know, he comes back and now he sort of has a new lease on life. Because he doesn't want to be that guy.
Yeah, and there's also so many things. Again, they don't ever say explicitly point this, but like you can see his. It's because all you have is his POV, and there's like three. There's three main clashes he has with protests in America. The first 4th of July parade, when he comes home and he's in his, you know, uniform and he's speaking and he sees people like flipping him off and they're angrily, you know, like these hippies kind of like in the corner, you know, it's just a very small pocket, right, of these angry people. And he's like, geez, what the fuck is going on with this? This is not, I don't like this. This is un-American, etc. The second is when he, you know, follows Donna, played by Kira Sedgwick, to a protest. And he sees like, okay, this is some kind of wild stuff, but I'm seeing people that like me. Look at this guy. He's this black guy's up there. He's got Purple Hearts. He's got combat valor medals. He's ripping them off and saying, "What are these even worth?" And that is starting to like he's like starting to jive with that. Like, okay, this guy is making a lot of sense what he's saying. And then the police form up and, you know, run them off with gas and I think that you're supposed to draw because the police form a line, right? Just like him and his platoon did going into that village and they advance and they're hurting all these people. He's still kind of on their side and he gets thrown to the ground and out of his wheelchair. And then late in the movie, he goes through that again at the Republican National Convention in 1974 or is it 72?
I think. Yeah.
And I just thought it was so interesting that like he gets beat up and then he gets medical evacuated and saved from arrest by, you know, one of his fellow Vietnam veterans, exactly the same way that he was saved in the war. You know, guy combat carrying him out of this hot zone and then him rallying the troops and like charging at gates again. There's no like dialogue to tell you about that. It's just his POV and seeing how he starts, you know, first of all, the protests get bigger and bigger and bigger and more organized. And it mirrors exactly kind of like the Vietnam resistance to the American part of the Vietnam War. I thought that was just really incredibly effective. And again, it's nothing but Tom Cruise's face and Johnny Williams' music. And, you know, fucking, Oliver Stone's "You Are There" approach to directing that tells that story. Yeah, they don't have the big acting moments that you're used to in movies like this.
Sure. Yeah. The big monologues and, you know, all the dialogue that would tell you what that character's thinking. But they use the callbacks frequently, nearing the end of this movie, or I guess in the second half of this movie, they're constantly calling back, right? Like I found it interesting that I learned after watching this movie that Ron Kovic was one of the veterans in that original 4th of July parade that it opens up with. He played the one who's flinching when the firecrackers go off.
Ah, okay, okay.
And then you see that exact same thing mirrored when Kovic comes back, and he's now the veteran in the car, you know, no longer the kid on the sidelines cheering on the veterans.
Flinching at fireworks.
The firecrackers, but also getting the finger put in his face. You know, if not literally, then figuratively being spit on. It's a stark contrast to the 4th of July parades he's familiar with, and also an informative callback about how things have changed since, you know, he was a kid and now.
But even then, I thought that was some really subtle performances going on with the veterans marching in the parade that, like, you know, you didn't have the protest. Everybody was cheering these people on as heroes. You know, these were, you know, middle-aged men from Korea in World War II.
Yeah.
But you still saw in a lot of these guys a haunted quality that didn't quite match the cheering and adulation they were getting. And I guess that's the thing. Other thing I thought... It is nice to be together as a society, and it sucks when we're divided as a society. But like, we're divided because this is important. You know, these are important things. It's not because a segment of the society ever just decides to start hating their country, right? It's because their country starts telling lies and starts spending lives unwisely, and you know. Exposing her hypocrisy, you know, like this, I'm sure this was like an amazing fresh thought in 1989, but like, you know, the various black men in both the army and in veterans hospital, they're like, you know, fuck Vietnam, essentially talking, you know, Muhammad Ali, like, what, I don't have any problem with the Vietnamese, I got a problem with the people that are keeping me down here in this country, and I identify with their struggle against oppression more than I identify with what my own government's trying to do. That's the thing that really, really upsets me, the facile way that we still engage with these debates, that like, oh, you must hate if you don't, you know, America, love it or leave it.
Yeah. And they hammer that phrase into the ground. This movie, like, it's all the Tom Cruise, it's all the Ron Kovic can say coming back from the war. You know, that's his entire viewpoint is America, 100% love it or 100% get the fuck out. Like,
right.
And that's not real life. That is patriotism at its worst. That blind patriotism is in my opinion not patriotism at all. If you are unquestioning, if you're unthinking, and you simply have a viewpoint that you stick to it, no matter what evidence you're presented with, no matter how incongruous it is with reality, that's not an ideology you should be living by.
Yeah, but I mean, and it's 100% right.
In Super, it is brought to a head, I think, in the at the RNC scene when Ron Kovic, having taken his entire adult life to change his mind on this subject, has finally come around to a reason, to an understanding of the situation and an understanding of his ideology, and then goes into this RNC. Where all he's confronted with is shouts of communist, shouts of baby killer, like shooting,
being spit on him, you know, like
spit on, like it's,
yeah,
it, he's come to some sort of understanding about the world that these people have not had the experience, have not had the opportunity to even approach, right? Because their ideology keeps them from even thinking about it.
And there's also another tough scene, I thought, in the bar where, you know, he is essentially bitching about the Vietnam War and he offends his World War II vet. It's like, look, buddy, I fought in Iwo Jima and 5,000 of my brothers died on day one of the landing. And I'm so fucking sick and tired of hearing you guys bitch about and cry into your beer. Like, that's not an invalid point of view, right? And like Ron Kovic, who goes through the experience that he goes through, takes years to turn his mind around. And it's one of those things where it's like, as much as I bemoan what's happening and the way it's talked about, like, I can't get too upset about it because I know it's taken my mind a lot of years to change on some very important kind of like obvious and retrospect issues. And it's taken me and you know, when you get presented with accurate information, it takes years to change your mind. And if it took Ron that long to turn around on the Vietnam War, well, how long would you expect a World War II vet or a Korean vet or someone that lost their parents in that war or lost a brother in that war, or who just has the default kind of public understanding of this stuff, like, you know, like believes that the government's not going to tell you a bunch of fucking obvious lies and is not going to lie about how winnable a war is and how much support you have. It's like, it's one of those things where it's like, God damn, none of these people are our enemies. They're just,
yeah,
you know,
that's what's so frustrating about the conversation that's happening now is that it's not a conversation. It's one side shouting the other down. Yeah. Exactly like you see in that scene at the RNC. It's people shouting communist. It's people shouting fascist. And it's not a conversation. It is ideologues trying to drown out the other side with their own ideology. And it isn't productive. And that's like social media is maybe the worst place to have this conversation, especially Twitter, like, which artificially intentionally limits the conversation to shout it as sure. succinctly and loudly as possible and encourage no conversation.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what 2-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Here's what it seems like the best way, like you say, need to have a conversation. How does Ron Kovacs have a productive conversation with a person who's super pro Nixon that thinks in 1972 that the Vietnam War is just about to be won? How does he have a productive conversation? It's like what you need to do is line up everyone in America by ideology and have like everyone slightly to the right of you on your right hand side and one to slightly to the left of you on your left hand side. And you turn left and right and you have those conversations you can have. But in real life, what happens is a guy 1,000 miles from you, you know, you're trying to convince someone on their side. They come flying in with the fucking napalm and the nuclear and the fascist and the communist. And because there are parts of this conversation that are completely invalid and there are people that are wrong. And those people that are wrong are causing a bunch of harm. And that's the thing. It's like it's this fucking Greek tragedy that like what you say is true. But also the act like Ron Kovic can have a reasoned discussion with a person who's gung ho in war.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing. Like in an ideal world, you would have discussions. You would have forums where you could come together and speak, you know, rationally. And try to actually convince people of why you believe the things you believe. But in the real world, that's just not how we operate.
It's almost like it's like a corollary to the talk we had about war. It's like war's hell, so don't do it unless it's like an existential threat, right? I feel like the same thing about this kind of thing is like this is the value of good leadership. Mm-hmm. you need to have a person, you need to have people that are thoughtfully engaging things, you know, spending money correctly, spending lives correctly. And then you have to have them taking the lead of like listening and keeping the discourse at a certain level, because once you get take to the streets, then you lose the ability to have that reasoned, you know, well, let me listen to you and all that stuff. And because I at some point, like, you do have to start screaming and shouting if the side that is wrong, sure, and the side is leading to people that's dying and stuff. But yeah, like, and how do you come back from that? Because like, that's the other thing is like, I definitely remember times in my life where we have been more united as a people, mm-hmm, but like, it does seem like something really important fractured somewhere around the 60s and 70s, and we haven't quite put it back together.
Yeah.
In fact, those divisions, you know, we keep on papering over them with stuff. And yeah, like, again, the fact that like, even, you know, what are we 40 years later off after the Born on the 4th of July, the fact that this is still probably, you know, I remember, people shitting on Ron Kovacs, when he had opened his mouth about the second Iraq war, you know, like people on Fox News and conservative commentators, like, you know, I see people still shit on Noam Chomsky, like he was wrong about the Vietnam War, like he's this crazy guy who's just been talking this radical liberal shit all of his life. No, some of these people were right and some of those people were wrong, and 40, 50 years later, we still can't call a spade. And I think that is one of the big reasons why it does feel like we're in Groundhog's Day, because as a society, we've never actually taken stock, and there's a new generation of people born with no understanding of their past, haven't done a great job teaching that stuff in schools, so we still are stuck in this, like, you know, fucking, it's cold out there, campers, put on your booties, every 10 years or so we have to have these same conversations, because we never definitively get to a winner and loser situation.
Yeah.
Which is really mind-blowing, since we're still like, it'd be like fighting about whether the Vietnam War is right in 1990 if we were still fighting the Vietnam War.
Sure.
You know, like, yeah, this is the kind of the life, yeah, the kind of life we're living in now.
I want to talk about some of the production of this film. So it was a critical success. It cost, I think, after reshoots and stuff, which is kind of interesting. So it was budgeted for $14 million. They turned in the final cut of this thing, and Universal said, I don't really like that RNC scene. Go back and shoot that again and make it bigger and better.
Oh, wow.
And so instead of the 600 extras that they had when they initially shot that scene, they reshot it with about 6,000.
Wow.
Making it, you know, bigger and better, literally. It ended up costing like $17.8 million. Worldwide, it made $161 million. So pretty successful for Oliver Stone and Universal, everybody involved.
And raking into Oscar gold, too.
Yeah, a couple of them. Mm-hmm. Now, there were some interesting choices, I guess first choices for the role of Ron Kovic that we have to talk about.
I wanted to get to this, yes.
First of all, there was Sean Penn and Charlie Sheen, which, okay, Sean Penn, I 100% believe could do it. I mean, Charlie Sheen, what, he was in Platoon, right? So, like, that was kind of a natural Oliver Stone, Charlie Sheen pairing. But the more interesting decision, in my opinion, would have been to go with their third choice, Nicolas Cage.
Can you imagine Nicolas Cage in the broken penis scene?
Oh, man, I would give just about anything to see that. It would be a very different tone.
Yeah.
But the performance would just be outstanding.
I would love to see Willem Dafoe and Nick Cage in a scenery chewing contest on the side of a Mexican highway.
Uh-huh.
I would like to see Nicolas Cage in that bar scene where he's challenging a World War II vet that lost 5,000 of his brothers in Iwo Jima. Like, you can see it, right? You can see how volcanic it would be.
Absolutely.
I guess my question is, what would Nick Cage look like in the high school scenes? Because in Tom Cruise was 27 when he made this film, but he still had this boyish quality where I thought it was a little creaky in the way that a lot of these Hollywood things are to buy that this guy is a senior in high school. But I think him and Kira Sedgwick both mostly pulled that off.
Oh yeah, I mean Tom Cruise has always looked younger than he is. Had sure. that boyish look to him.
He's 75 now, and he still looks younger than I am.
Now, legitimately, he's 58, and he looks outstanding. Yeah,
yeah, he does. He doesn't look 40.
No,
I don't think.
No, he looks better than I do. So here's for context. Here's what Nicolas Cage was in at the time, around 1989. Mm-hmm. So 87 to 89, it was like Raising Arizona, Moonstruck, Vampire's Kiss, like that era.
Mm-hmm.
He's looking pretty young in those things, but he's like never Vincent... he's never looked as young as Tom Cruise looks now, let alone in 1989. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like he's like kind of like the Vincent Kartheiser type, where you know, even without, he just looks like he was born as in his mid 30s, you know.
Yep.
Yep. But I don't know, because like also Ron Kovac, he, you know, seemed like he was balding at an early age, so maybe that they would have paid that would have all played off, and they put a nice hairpiece on him. I don't know, but I do wonder how he would have played in those early scenes. But speaking of those early scenes, I was actually surprised that Kira Sedgwick played such an important part in the first half of this movie and then completely disappeared after that one protest scene. I forget at what university it was.
Yeah.
She, I think, was the reason he showed up to the anti-war protest in the first place.
I think so.
But then they get separated in that, and like you never see her again. She's in a brief flashback as he's like thinking about his life at some point. I think this is when he's getting beat down at the RNC convention. I was a little surprised. I guess that's maybe how it went in real life, but usually I'm used to Hollywood like punching that up and like, you know, giving her like either writing her out of the movie and doing something else, like building an emotional core around, because it's weird. They didn't have a relationship. Like, I guess she was sweet on him as a child, but he was shy, never picked up on it. And then, you know, he did this very showy display at the prom night. But like, I never really got that he meant a lot to her and vice versa. It wasn't like I expected to be kind of like a Ginny from Forrest Gump kind of situation.
Oh, yeah.
But it never really got there. So
no, it seemed like it was not the right time or place for that relationship. You know, he was still unsure how he felt about this whole thing. She was very much into the protests.
I thought they could have connected, but why though? Like, why have her be this kind of like semi-romantic figure? Like, I thought maybe it would be like, you know, he just doesn't think he's worthy of her because his legs don't work and his dick doesn't work, or there's going to be some kind of thing like that. But she just really just evaporates at the halfway point in the movie.
Yeah, I felt like she was there to get him to the protest. And, you know, this is weird to say in the context of an autobiographical film, but like, I felt like she was there to get him to the protest so he could begin that journey toward changing his mind. And with her absence, why would he be at those protests, right?
Well, I was just thinking that, like, they also established his brother as this, like, pretty strong anti-war thing. So I thought they could have had, like, something like that, or old Vietnam vet. Like, you know, I'm sure they took liberties with Ron Kovic's story at some place. Like, just felt like an untidy part. But maybe also that's part of the point, is that, you know, you never know what's going to be the formative experience or what's going to be the thing that leads you down a particular path. But I don't know. That was like, I thought, a little bit of a flaw in the movie, because I kept on expecting her to show up and then the movie was over and I'm like, oh fuck, what happened to her?
Yeah.
But I don't know. That's pretty minor criticism of the film. What did you think of the film where he finally gets the courage to meet the man he kills, the Wilsons, their family? I thought that was really interesting. Was that his last stop before fully plunging himself in the anti-war movement? Like he's trying to find some kind of absolution.
Yeah.
Something that like puts that hole in his heart that got blown out by that bullet in Vietnam.
Yeah. And if he can't resolve like the global scale, tragedy here, he's at least going to deal with his own personal responsibility that he feels, the personal guilt he feels over it.
But I don't think it worked. That's the thing that I came away from that scene, is that this was him trying to get right with his humanity. And like, you know, the mom said, oh, we understand. The dad, I don't think, was pretty angry. And, you know, the guy's fiance and mother of his child is, you know, not offering him forgiveness. And then you're right. Like, if he can't solve the world's problems on a global stage, and he gets beat in Vietnam, then he tries to solve, like, okay, well, maybe I can and solve my personal struggles, and that doesn't work. And that's when he throws himself into, well, maybe I can keep other boys from going through the same fate as I did.
Yeah.
And that's when he throws himself into the war movement.
It's a great scene, I thought, and a great performance from Tom Cruise.
It also mirrored him trying to confess to his commanding officer.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the whole kind of him, like, trying to find the words and, like, starting off, like... Like, I felt like through both of those scenes, he kept on crossing the line of, like, am I actually going to do this? Or no, I'm not going to do that. Well, let me talk about this first, and then I talk... It's so... Man, I want to watch this movie again, because I felt like there's so many things that mirror each other.
Yeah.
Things in the first act that pay off in the third act, and this was definitely one of them. Like, and in neither one of those, I think he walked away with absolution. Mm-hmm. Like, his commanding officer could have... I don't know if you court-martialed the guy, because war is hell and this is an honest mistake. And, you know, you're his commanding officer. You put him in this situation with these troops that were trained with this equipment, with this intelligence, with this mission. But like the whole idea of, like, why are you wasting my time with this shit? Get out there and get back to fighting, devil dog. Like, that, you know, was not what Tom Cruise needed to hear in that moment.
No. And it's interesting because, you know, like, they do make a point about the lack of support for the veterans as they come back to society.
Oh, man.
But it's, you know, it's largely focused on the physical support that they need. They need mm-hmm. treatment for their wounds. They need, you know, safe housing, things like that. But there's one point in the movie where I couldn't help but notice it's that penis scene where his mom's just like, you need help. You need help. You're sick. You need help. She never... And I don't think at the time she would have really said, like, you need some therapy, you need to talk to someone, you
right.
need some mental help here, because...
She's thinking you need Jesus, you know, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like, that's their solution for everything, is just, oh, well, get close to God. But it's... So it's not really, like, pointed out in, like, stark detail there, but it's also very much alluded to, I think, especially now in the modern context. I don't know about 1989... People right. were like, oh, yeah, therapy is the way to go for, you know, a lot of people coming back from these traumatic experiences.
Yeah, yeah.
So the movie, like, I'm not sure the movie's trying to say that, but I couldn't help but think it while I was watching it.
Mm.
That the help, like, she's saying, yes, that the thing that he needs, but.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing.
Speaking of cyclical cycles that we get stuck in, the VA administration and hospitals, it's insane to me that you are off asking these sacrifices from these men, and then they come home. This is the shit that they have to deal with
yeah.
for their health care. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is something that's a perennial issue. Like, we're fighting this war in the Middle East, and it has, you know, it's killed a lot of people. It's maimed a lot of people. VA is still underfunded. And you want to, and your point, one of the crucially and critically underfunded things is the emotional side of support for our soldiers, like helping them return to home, helping them get over their post-traumatic stress. You know, there's a lot of like issues that our veterans are facing that we, you know, it's like, I wonder like what, you know, there is some kind of like Gulf War syndrome that's somewhat analogous to like the Agent Orange stuff that the men experienced in the jungles of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Like, it does seem like that we are very good at planning for the ass kicking, but we have really no plan, like in the uptick of soldiers needing medical support and psychological support afterwards. And that's yet another thing that I don't think our nation has learned, is like, we love to say how much we love our troops. You know, we live in a section of this country where we have still to this day, giant, we support our troop banners over all of our exchanges and overpasses and stuff. But shit, if we really love our troops, then first of all, we wouldn't only put them in harm's way when we have an existential threat. And two, when we do that, we would fucking take care of them.
Yeah.
You know, we wouldn't have, I don't know that they're still, but I know that at one point, like 10 years ago, veterans were one of the highest percentage of people that made up the homeless population in this country. And when you look at stuff like that, when you look at what their job prospects are, like, you know, someone that comes home and is blinded or have their legs blown off, it's just really sad. Again, the fact that, like, can we not all agree, at least in 2020, that we should at least adequately fund the veterans hospitals, yeah, the Veterans Administration? Like, is that not something we can do to support the troops? It seems crazy that, yeah. Or, you know, the other thing is, like, if you would expect that one side would be all gung-ho about supporting it and the other side would be starving it. And you know what? The sides that you might think are completely opposite. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That's, like I said, this movie is a very frustrating movie because it's amazing. It's good. It's soul-searing. But it's also frustrating because I just feel like we, and on so many different axes in society, we could be right back into this situation again. And we already are, in, like, when it comes down to, like, the Black Lives Matter movement and police brutality, we kind of already are in that point. So glad we didn't get in a war with Iraq or Iran.
Yeah. There's some weird cameos in this that I wanted to bring up real quickly. One of those cameos is a guy named Wayne Knight that you might remember from a little show called Seinfeld that, you know, I think was already premiered at this point. It had to have been.
I don't know who you're talking about, but I do know him as Dennis Nedry from Jurassic Park.
There's that as well, which had yet to come out. But so Newman from Seinfeld is in this for like 30 seconds. He's like one of the guys at the RNC who's just sort of in the background, right? Or the DNC.
It's a DNC in the 76. Yeah, you're right. And I don't think he has a speaking line.
No, he's just there and I think he pushes the wheelchair or opens a door for him and then he's done. I guess that would have been pretty early in his career, but it's not like he was a nobody then.
Yeah, I'm because he's also has a much bigger speaking part. I mean, not a huge part, but a much bigger speaking part in JFK, the movie. And I'm starting to see that, like, Oliver Stone seems like he's one of those guys who's very loyal.
Yeah.
You know, like Willem Dafoe was one of the co-stars of Platoon. And also, I don't know this guy's name, but one of the other co-stars was the lead, the gunnery sergeant recruiter that marches into the high school.
Yeah, Tom Berenger. Like,
yeah, there you go. He does seem like he keeps these people around even for like bit parts and stuff. Uh-huh. And like, you know, Wayne Knight, I don't know. He must have impressed him because he got called back for JFK for a much larger part later. I think JFK, the movie, is in 91, 2 years after this. Yeah. So you got cut. I wonder if that DNC scene was like he had some lines and stuff, because also who's the prick from Scrubs?
Oh, John C. McGinley. Yeah, he's the asshole doctor.
He's right there. Like, you know, Wayne Knight is on his left and this guy's on his right. And they both have like 30 seconds of screen time with zero dialogue. And I wonder if there was a bigger scene that just got cut later. And Oliver Stone's like, hey, I'll bring you back for such and such a movie at a different time. But he works with a lot of these people.
I want to say
again and again.
Is it Billy Baldwin who's also in that scene? There's definitely a Baldwin behind him at one point.
Yep, there definitely is.
I can't remember if it's this or something else I was watching recently, but I think the lawyer from Scrubs is also in this.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Maybe it was something else I was watching. But there's so many of those just like small... they're almost extras. They're mm-hmm. they're at that level in this film, and yet they're pretty big names even at the time.
Yeah, I was there's so many. I should have written them all down, but Tom Sizemore.
Right. Also in Platoon,
right? Is in that he's also the one that the role that I always stands out in my mind is he plays a sergeant in Saving Private Ryan.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's like all these people are they're just you know, hanging around in the fringes that are either about to have a big career or had a big career or continue to have a big career. It's pretty cool.
It's crazy. And then the last production note I wanted to bring up, which is maybe even crazier than the previous one. Did you know that Oliver Stone wanted to inject Tom Cruise with drugs that would paralyze his legs for 2 days? And that the insurance company had to shut that shit down?
Because I think Tom Cruise would do it.
He would 100% do it, and it would 100% be a bad idea. Yeah. Like, I don't get this. Like, you don't have to throw somebody off a building to get the reaction of them falling off a building. You don't have to paralyze someone to get them to act like they're paralyzed. They are actors, right, for God's sake, Oliver Stone.
Yeah.
Just let them do their jobs.
Who was it? It was a Laurence of Olivia, or was it Peter O'Toole, that like some method actor was talking about all these grueling things he did to prepare for the, and then this guy like took a sip of his brandy and said, you know, you should try acting, old boy. It's a lot easier than all that shit you're doing.
Like, was that Sidney Poitier who said that?
It might have been. It was one of those like actors that, yeah, was like, yeah, why? What is this shit? Going to living in a cabin for 6 months, prepare for, like, nah, fucking, you know. I that is insane that you would willingly, because there's got to, right, be, there's not an insignificant risk that you just never start walking again after that.
No,
like,
that
let me
was,
shoot
that
botulism.
That was the worry, yeah, of the, yeah, insurance company. They were like, he might never walk again, and he's a huge movie star.
Yeah, how would you even insure for that? Like, the Tom Cruise's collective box office from 1989?
Right.
I mean, we could get the real number with the benefit of hindsight, but how do you write that policy?
Yeah.
Like some $2 billion legs or something. Like,
yeah, it would
fuck?
Probably bankrupt the production. I don't think you could pay the insurance on that.
Yeah.
The premium.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. That was insane to me.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting, like Ron Kovic's like wanting, oh God, that's another gruesome scene where he got that compound fracture trying to walk with no legs. He's such a driven dude, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the kind of guy that like you don't want to have against you if you're fighting for, you want on your side when you're fighting for a cause.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all I got.
All right, Born on the 4th of July. It's a great movie. I'm glad I watched it. Now I've seen two of the three of the Oliver Stone trilogy of Vietnam. I have not seen, is it Heaven and Earth?
Yeah.
That one's interesting. It stars Tommy Lee Jones, and it's more about the Vietnamese experience, like what it's like to be a person kind of caught in that civil war. Because we don't ever really think about it in terms of like, you know, it was a real civil war in Vietnam, brother against brother. It really tore that. I mean, however many people we lost, they lost 10, 20, 30 times more. And we're a much smaller, poorer country to begin with. So I think I want to see that next, to see, because these were all made like 2 or 3 years apart from each other. It's kind of cool that he was able to bring all that perspective to the roles. Mm-hmm. Next week, it's going to be the 10th anniversary of one Christopher Nolan's Inception. One of our very first movie reviews, what we did in the old Blue Yonder days, was of this movie. And we were actually just going to re-release it as like, you know, and we listened to it like, holy shit, this sounds like terrible. We recorded this in Jim's apartment, I think a couple days before you moved out. So it was all like
maybe
echoey.
On one microphone.
Yeah, we passed around a mic and we're like, this is terrible. And you know what? I want to see Inception again. It's a 10th year anniversary. So we're going to watch Christopher Nolan's Inception. It's a real brain bender. I love the movie. I got a lot of thoughts about it. I'm really excited to see it again. So that's what we're going to be doing next week. If you guys want to, you know, get a little prep, do your homework and watch it with us. But we'll be back next week with that for our bald movie. Until next time, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
I'll see you.